This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, it's Josh.
Hi, and it's Joe.
And you're about to listen to another great episode of The Movies That Made Me. Just want to give you a heads up. Many of the movies, occasionally we'll talk about something that's pretty obscure and has never come out on video. Most of the movies we talk about on the show are available at moviesunlimited.com, which is the movie collector's website.
Yeah, don't waste your time streaming or looking for your favorites on TV. You can own them.
Physical media, babies. Yes, go to the trailersfromhell.com website. Click the Movies Unlimited banner on the website and you can buy your favorites from them or go right to moviesunlimited.com. Shipping is always free on orders over $50.
Movies, movies, movies.
Where are you?
I'm in Calabasas. We shot one day for season two of Creepshow and then they pushed the pause button. So I'm calling this the pause. Because I can't think of any other way to have it make any sense other than that.
I'm going to try to keep this part short because we actually do want to talk to you. But writer, producer, director, second unit director.
And effects makeup.
I was getting to that, Joseph. Effects makeup. My favorite, stuntman.
Oh, that's right. I've done some stuff.
Archive footage. Yeah, that's not actually a job. Okay. But we're here with Greg Nicotero from Creepshow, from Walking Dead. Actually, Walking Dead's been coming up a lot on our pandemic parade specials. We've been asking people to talk about what they're watching while they're locked up under quarantine. And I think there's a real straight line between people who find it now to be the great time to watch things about zombie apocalypse and people who don't. But there are a lot of folks. I think they finish watching Outbreak and then they want something more and they segue into Walking Dead.
I still don't quite understand that logic. But...
I should wait until we're done before I alienate you, but I want to lodge a complaint. We're huge fans of Dana Gould on this show, but as a portly gentleman, I am deeply offended by the fact that you had to go outside the tribe to get someone to play a portly gentleman. As good as Dana was.
Well, you know, I remember there were times when Dana was slightly portlier than he is now. And to be honest, I hadn't seen him in a while because he was doing his thing. You know, when he showed up, I was like, son of a bitch, you're thinner than I remember.
Well, that'll change after this pandemic, I suspect. We're all just sitting around eating and drinking. But Greg, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, man. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I know we've been talking about trying to do this for the last 3 years, I think.
Have we been on that long? We've been on, oh God, how long have we been on, Joe?
Yeah, longer than you think.
About that.
we are about to drop our 75th guest, so I guess we have been around for a while. Well, thank you. You're doing the tour right now from your home, promoting Creepshow.
Yep.
The first season of which is being released on DVD and Blu-ray today, June 2nd, 2020, which is such a fun show, man. How do you describe the aesthetic of the show? Cause it really captures something. It really has a beautiful approach to the material that is funny and scary at the same time.
Well, you know, I really keyed in on one major thing, which is that tagline on the poster, which said, it's the most fun you'll ever have being scared. And I really realized that the horror genre benefits so much from variety. And in this day and age where you have a lot of people that, whether they want to commit to something long form or not, the truth of the matter is little sort of short bites of horror material and stuff that can be scary, it can be fun, it can be outrageous, seemed to be the right time for that. You know, I mean, I love Night Gallery, and I even like the idea that like there was Night Gallery episodes that had like a segment that was like 2 minutes.
Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
And when we originally started developing Creepshow, I said, guys, we have to go for that comic book experience. Like you're reading a comic book. Because I think the network was like, yeah, let's just do a 1 hour anthology. And I said, it doesn't really work that way. You need multiple stories. You can't just have one story. So
yeah.
We originally started with the idea of doing 3 stories in one episode. And when we started getting into the production, the realizations that I bit off way more than I could chew, we cut it from 3 to 2. And that was what I felt most important, was that you could watch one episode and it would be about this weird sort of haunted dollhouse. And then you'd have another episode that would be, you know, this weird relationship between a father and his son set in the backdrop of alcoholism and codependence. So that was really what excited me about it, and being able to work with other filmmakers. And, you know, Joe was one person that I originally reached out to, and was really, because I felt like Joe's aesthetic for telling stories and keeping them light, but keeping them scary and having the right, the right identity. Yeah. It's just, honestly, our production schedule was so ridiculous. You know, I mean, three and a half days to shoot a segment. I kind of realized that was asking a lot for anybody to try to come in and do something like that. It was just a bit crazy. So,
especially if you have to go to Canada.
Yeah, but we went to Atlanta, so anyway, you know, I feel like, you know, I was just thinking about the show, and initially, you know, if I would do it all again and go back and do season 1, because, you know, I hadn't been a showrunner before. I'd been on The Walking Dead, and I was pretty hands-on with that show for the last 10 years. But when you're the showrunner, I had this sort of idea that, well, I wanted to have my hands in everything. You know, I wanted to design the comic book covers, and I wanted to design all of the page turns. And so when we started developing the show and doing the scripts, I really was like overseeing everything, and I didn't learn or know better to sort of dole out some of those responsibilities. So it was really, a really rough situation. And when I got into post and I started editing the episodes and realized that, you know, that it was going to be a lot harder than I thought, I really had to buckle in and force myself through. But the one thing that showed was the heart that I put into the series, and that I really cared, and that all the actors and all the directors and all the writers, they also really came, everybody came for the same reason. And I feel like that's what makes Creepshow successful.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. I just want to say, because we're not, you know, we pride ourselves on not talking about our guests' work, and we've already blown that right out of the gate. But I'll say one thing before we jump into your movies. You without giving anything away, you did an episode that has, I think, one of my favorite werewolf transformations outside of The Howling. A very clever usage of the structure of your show to get by, I'm sure, some budget considerations. But just a wonderful, wonderful transformation sequence.
Well, thank you. Listen, I mean, Rob Schraub, who wrote and directed that episode, he was one of the first people that we had reached out to. I mean, I knew Rob when he was working on the Sarah Silverman show, and he has the perfect aesthetic, you know, even so much as, you know, a lot of that stuff was even in the script, you know, when the werewolf knocks the guy's head off and the blood sprays the window, and then as the blood runs down the window, the color changes to red. You know, I mean, I think he probably more than any of the other directors embraced the Creepshow comic book flair, which I think was very, very important for setting the show aside. And I got a call from the LA Times and they said, how do you feel about creating a show that is accessible horror? And I'd never heard that expression before. What's accessible horror? And they said, well, in this day and age, you know, it's not overly gratuitous. There's not nudity. There's not a lot of swearing. You created a show that was accessible to more than just one particular demographic. And I had never thought about it that way, but I think because in certain instances, the show was a little lighter. Plus, I really wanted to embrace the aesthetic of the movies that I grew up loving, like the movies in the 70s and 80s, Dawn of the Dead. And of course, all of Joe's movies, which I'm not trying to kiss butt, but I'm a big fan of Joe's work and Joe's work inspired me on Creepshow.
Well, let's take that as a segue then and go into some of the movies that, I don't know, what's the phrase?
Made me.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of those?
Yeah.
Greg, like where are you, what started you on this path? What's your,
Well, my dad was one of the first people that had a VCR. He was a big gadget guy. So he was friends with these guys that owned a store downtown Pittsburgh called Opus One. And they had all of the latest technology. So he had the old reel-to-reel video recorder. So you'd have to thread the reel through it, and then you would hit the record button, and you would turn it on. And this was probably, I would say, in the mid-70s, 74, 75. We had a reel-to-reel video recorder.
Oh, wow.
So there was a device that you would have to plug into the back of your TV and plug it into the VCR. And again, there was no cable, so it was rabbit ears. And I started recording movies. And the first two movies that I recorded was The Time Machine and Horror of Dracula. So
fantastic. How did they look?
They looked fantastic.
Did they really? Okay.
They looked amazing. And the funny thing is they would have commercials. So you'd have to stop recording when the commercials come on, and then you'd have to push the button and start recording again. And I remember the biggest faux pas was when you would forget to start recording again when the movie started. And you'd be sitting there going, oh shit, and you'd run over and you'd hit the record button. So from when I was probably 10 years old, we started collecting movies. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, King Kong versus Godzilla, anything that was playing on the Saturday afternoon matinees that played in Pittsburgh. And then, of course, Saturday nights, there was a show called Chiller Theater that was hosted by Bill Cardill. Now, Bill was the weatherman, and he was a local sort of celebrity. He played the reporter in Night of Living Dead. What do you say, Chief? How do we keep these? Well, you shoot him in the head, you shoot him and burn him. Like, that was Bill Cardill. So for me, interestingly enough, when I first saw Night Living Dead, I was like, wait, that reporter is the guy who I watched the news from. So it kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
Every Saturday night, he would play two movies. And this was, ironically, when Saturday Night Live came on, Pittsburgh would preempt SNL to play a double feature of Chiller Theater. And then Saturday Night Live would come on afterwards. And then when Saturday Night Live took off, they shifted it. So I'd have to stay up until 1 o'clock in the morning to watch horror movies.
To one shortest season. Yeah.
So anyway, so I started this collection of movies that I loved, that meant a lot to me, and I would be able to watch them over and over again. So I really became enamored with the visuals, with, like The Time Machine, like the makeups on the Morlocks and the matte paintings and the special effects. And I realized that those fantasy films and those elements appealed to me a lot. And I became enamored with the idea of creating these fantastic worlds. That's how I really, really got into it. You know, my parents are still huge movie buffs, and you know, they took me to the theater. I saw From Russia with Love in the theater. I saw Planet of the Apes in the theater. And 2001, which I still had no idea what the hell it was about, but my parents loved movies. So they took us to the theater all the time. So I felt like anytime a movie came out, within a couple days, they would see it first to make sure it was appropriate for us, and then we would go see it. So that's kind of how it started.
So wait, so they saw 2001 and went, little Greggy will enjoy this?
Well, I think that they were struck by just the beauty of it. And the joke that we used to have is, sure, my mom, like, we'd go to Mother's Day, we'd go out for dinner, and 2001 was in theaters for a long time. So we would take my mom to dinner, and then we would go see 2001. And she was like, can we see something else other than two? Nope, we're going to see 2001. So that's how it started for me. And, you know, Bill Cardill would then play in July, he would play classic movie. So he would go into the vault and he would play all of the Universal monster movies. So it was Wolfman and Frankenstein, and we recorded all of them. So I would have to stay up till 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning and record these movies. And then we would be able to go back and watch them. So I felt like I had a weird sort of ownership to those films, because I could go to the closet and take it out of the closet at any time I wanted and watch it. I felt very connected to those films and the special effects of, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon suit and the Wolfman and a lot of those movies. So I was really, really sort of initially intrigued by the makeup part of it. And then you get into the reruns of Star Trek and Lost in Space. And then I started becoming interested in movie miniatures and models. And that was a completely different world. And, you know, I remember seeing the Poseidon Adventure probably 11 times in the movie theater because of the disaster movie aspect of it. And I loved the big miniature of the Poseidon. Mm-hmm. And then when you get into the Towering Inferno, and the Towering Inferno to me was a really important movie for me, because I wanted to start building models and I wanted to start building miniatures because of the Towering Inferno. So I would take little like Lego sets and I would build buildings, and then I would get like an aerosol can with a lighter and I would film them with Super 8 and burn them and melt them and make movies.
Wow.
So that was a big, you know, and that was, I think Towering Inferno came out December of 73 or 74. Mm-hmm. So those movies meant a lot to me, because then I started thinking, well, it's not just makeup, but it's sort of the world of special effects, that there's these guys that,
yeah,
they build miniatures and they build practical puppets and they build, you know, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was a big movie for me because of,
sure,
just the majesty of, like, well, how did they make it look like they were underwater? And then the big model of the Nautilus and the squid and all that kind of stuff. So I just found myself gravitating towards those kinds of movies. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. If I could nerd out for just 1 minute, what, cause I'm fascinated. I guess I sort of knew about the pre VHS video recorders. I didn't know anyone who had one, you know, at their home. Were, How long were the tapes? How much could you hold an entire film on one reel?
The tapes were an hour, and that was the other thing that would bone you, because you'd have to. That's funny you would bring that up.
Well, you'd have to figure out when the ad break would come. That would allow
you'd have to figure out where the end break, or you'd get to a commercial and you'd look at how much tape was left, and you'd have to fast forward,
do the math,
get that tape, and thread another one, or you'd be taping a movie. I think when like Thunderball was on, we were recording it and it ran out, and you'd have to become an expert at grabbing another tape. And, you know, I think that's what they used in television stations and news reports, because after that, then there was,
right,
the next recorder that we got, and I think some of it too, ended up my dad, because he's a kidney specialist. There was a lot of interest in the dialysis center and raising money. And I know Charlton Heston was involved in raising money for that. So they would record these videos. So the next player that we got after that was this thing called a U-matic. And it was the big square 1 hour cassettes that you would shove in. You see them in, like, if you watch old like broadcast news, or you watch an old movie where they work in a TV station, they shove those tapes in. It was before Beta existed. Beta became, I think, the next incarnation. So you had the reel-to-reel, then the big U-matic square tapes that were about that big. And then Beta was smaller.
And what happened to you as a young collector of this stuff when, say, VHS came in and you could no longer get the reel-to-reels? I mean, was there this kind of, like, you've got this collection. This is such nerd shit, but you have this collection of movies you can't watch anymore. Did you have to go back and retape them all over again? Or
no, that happened to people. That happened to people who bought video discs, you know.
Well, this was before, yeah. But yeah, you're right, Joe, because when video discs came out, the first ones came out and they had the needle. And the needle would play it, and you'd stick it in and it would pull the disc out. So what ended up happening, Josh, was that we were all in on Beta. Like, when Beta came out, we started recording everything and collecting everything that we could on Beta. But some of the other shows that we had on the reel-to-reel, we couldn't get them again. And you couldn't copy them over. We didn't have the technology to copy from reel-to-reel. So when our reel-to-reel player died, that was it. We couldn't get those movies back.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't be surprised if I flew to Pittsburgh right now and started opening some of the closets. Some of those reel-to-reel tapes would still be there. But the trick was, if you kept them in the lower shelf of the closet, and then somebody would come by and run the vacuum, they would demagnetize the tape.
Oh no!
So there were multiple nights of numerous tears out of a young Greg Nicotero's face when I would put a movie on to play and all you got was snow.
I'm weeping for that child right now. I could
that happened a lot. I think, like, there was like the pilot episode of Land of the Giants that was demagnetized because someone ran the vacuum cleaner next to it. So those movies and honestly, that's when sort of bootlegging became a thing, because then these guys in New York started putting cameras in the backs of movie theaters and filming movies and then selling them. And people could then have all those movies on at their at home.
Except they had those little Mystery Science figures walking around, sitting down, and walking through the picture.
Or people coughing, and at one point,
talking through them.
Or the camera would be just tilted slightly, and you would hear everybody laughing. I think I remember seeing a video of Young Frankenstein that somebody had shot in the back of a movie theater. And the audio was coming from the screen. So anybody that was sitting, you'd hear the people talking in front of the camera. But, that was kind of part of, as the world progressed in terms of making that kind of entertainment available. And I remember when The Towering Inferno came out on Beta, it was two parts, and it was about $180 to buy the movie. Like, they weren't cheap. It wasn't like it wasn't like $19.99 or so. It was $180, and the tapes were only an hour long, because then you had like slow play versus long play versus super long play, and the quality was shittier the longer the tape was.
Right.
And I remember buying The Towering Inferno on home video, and it was like $180.
People forget that all the early VHSs that when those video stores bought those VHSs from those companies, they had to pay $100 a tape. That was one of their, and it cost like what, 50 cents to make it. And it was just a cash cow for these guys.
Yeah. And then they would start renting them. So then you would go in. I mean, the video store boom, which is gone. But, you know, I remember knowing when movies would come out. And you would go to the video store and you'd stand in the new release section. And it was, you know, so many movies that were important to us as filmgoers. And then you would start realizing that these filmmakers made other films, you know, because a lot of the people that owned the video stores were movie buffs. So that was when all of a sudden they started making suggestions. Oh, you like the movie of this guy? Well, you should watch this and you should watch this. So video stores really, for me, because I felt like I was a little ahead of that curve in terms of being, you know, collecting movies because my parents were movie buffs, but it really became a form of a film education class, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, how many times, Joe, did you and I meet at Dave's Laser when Laserdiscs came out?
Oh, yeah. That was the place to go in L.A. for
It was the place to go. And you know, between Mick Garris and like, everybody would have all the signings, and you'd go and you'd buy a Laserdisc and you'd go through and you'd get people to sign it. But on Saturday afternoons, Dave's Laser was, like, the place to go, not only because you could get rare you could get rare imports, but that other filmmakers wanted to celebrate, you know, movies that people might not know.
I know. And now there's really no place to do that anymore. You know, there's television and there's Trailers from Hell, which is about the only place you can go now to get people to curate you and say, well, you should see this movie. Or how about this guy? And what about this genre?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's tough because younger people aren't exposed the way you were to all the things that were going on and to older pictures. And so as a result, they don't know who a lot of these people are.
Yeah. Well, and it's unfortunate because a lot of those films that shaped who we became, you know, like I remember seeing, like, one of my favorite movies is Philip Kaufman's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, the 1978 version. And that movie was, it just, from the moment I started watching that movie, I had this weird sense of dread. Mm-hmm. And I could not understand why I felt that way. And when you look at the movie as an exercise in creating that dread, like the camera, you know, like the lighting was always low, so it was creating those weird shadows and the wide angle lenses and just sort of getting really close to people's faces, but shooting them wide so that it looked like you were in this very strange kind of fever dream. I was always fascinated with movies that sort of created that sense of unease, and you didn't even really know why you were feeling it, but you were anxious about it. You know, I mean, the opening credit scene where it starts with the alien little eggs on the other planet, and then they float and they get caught up in the atmosphere, and then it rains, and you see them growing on the leaves. Like, you're telling the audience already, okay, this is something bad.
Everything. Yeah, that is such a great film, and I'm to this day haunted by that fucking dog.
Which
the one with the human face.
I talked to Tom Berman because, you know, Tom Berman designed that face, and I think he still has that actual prosthetic mask that the dog wore.
Oh. Does he put it on his dog every now and then, let it run around the house?
I hope he puts it on his dog and not, like, walks around the house going, "Arr." I don't know.
Yeah. That's so fantastic. I just, before we get to the next one, I just want to say I realized as you were talking, the first $150 I ever earned as a writer, I spent at Dave's buying the Dr. Strangelove Laserdisc, the entirety.
You'd think they'd still be in business with that kind of money.
Yeah. Yeah. But
that discs were expensive, and I still had, listen, I kept all of mine. I still have all my discs. There's a
Did
lot
you?
Of, yeah, but beware of laser.
I know, unfortunately. But there's a lot of those special features that you can't get on updated.
The Citizen Kane disc has these immense number of interviews, including one from me, that have never been ported over to any other release of the picture. And they're fascinating. I mean, really, they're major filmmakers, and they're talking about this great movie. And it was like, I don't know if it's a rights issue or what the deal is, but it never got used on any of the video releases.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, I think people feel like, if we're going to do another release, we have to update the special features. And a lot of times some of the stuff that's on the original special features, you know, like the Star Wars, I still have the Star Wars disc and the Jaws disc. And, you know, there's so much great stuff that's interviews with people at that time. If they come back and interview them again, they're going to tell a different story, or they might not remember.
Or they don't live anymore. You know, I mean, there's so many people who passed away. The Bad Day at Black Rock disc has a commentary by John Sturges, which is fascinating, but it's never been used for any other release. And so you have to hang on to your Laserdisc.
I believe that commentary track is on YouTube, thankfully. The one that kills me is the Baron Munchausen disc was just packed to the gills with amazing stuff.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. Such a great movie, too. But anyway, Greg, you want to give us a few more?
Okay. I got to look at my list again because
But you've covered a bunch of them already.
Because they all kind of sort of feel like they seamlessly kind of run together, you know. It's just kind of funny, but you know,
let me ask you this before you get into it. I'm assuming you've got Blu-rays of all those movies you taped by hand 40 years ago.
Oh, I do. Yes.
And deep down in your heart, which do you value more, your Blu-ray or your shitty reel-to-reel videotapes?
Well, the reel-to-reel tape, here's the trick. You'd have to, and again, this is something that people don't appreciate or understand, but when we were younger and we were interested in these kinds of films, you had to work at it. Like you'd get the TV guide, and the TV guide would show up on Thursdays, and you'd go through and you'd have to circle the movies that you wanted to watch. And you had to be sitting by the TV when that movie was on. You couldn't access it anytime you wanted. And a lot of times I really equate that to why so many of us have that same sort of shared experience of, because you had to work at it.
Yeah.
You know?
And that made the experience special, because it's not like you can, and we take for granted the fact you can go over to your closet and pull out a Blu-ray of a movie you love, but we had to go to the trouble sometimes to just get in the car and go to the theater and see the movie, which made the whole experience different than it was if somebody just hands you a disc and says, here, play this, I think you'd like it. Because the whole idea of going out among people, seeing it with an audience, particularly this kind of picture and comedies, is not the same when they're experienced the way that we experience films today.
And even that's still going away, because people, it's a convenient thing. I mean, I don't think a lot of people really appreciate the idea of the communal experience of seeing a movie when you know, like when Ben Gardner's head popped out of the boat in Jaws, which is that always seminal talked about moment where people reacted. I remember seeing all the people's heads in the movie theater in front of me all recoil at the exact same second, like a sonic wave. And that can't help but affect you. It can't help but you know, add to the experience. And it makes me sad that movie theaters are getting smaller and smaller, unless people really appreciate that. Because, you know, when Alien came out and it was 70 millimeter Dolby and you sit in the theater and you'd hear the noise from behind you and the sounds and everything rumbled, and it immersed you in it. And that's what I always That's what I always loved about it. I love that immersive experience, or just, you know, feeling like you're surrounded by it, you know? You know, and listen, there was one movie that popped up today that I didn't forget about, but I think when I initially did my list, I kind of went for like movies that inspired me as a as an effects artist, and was sort of in awe of those. But you know, there's one movie that's a comedy that actually, like, we would go to dinner with my family and we would quote this movie at dinner. We'd sit around the table, and it's What's Up, Doc?
Ugh.
Peter Bogdanovich movie. And that was another one of those movies that we would sit there and quote Kenneth Mars' dialogue over and over again. Oh, you need, you know, can you fix a hi-fi? No, I mean, I can still do it to this day. It's such a crazy, zany, weird, random movie. And when you realize that Buck Henry wrote it and that Bogdanovich directed it, and it was intended to be this kind of screwball comedy, I realized, Josh, when I had sent you that list yesterday, that I didn't really put a lot of comedies in there. I thought, oh, it's all genre stuff, and it's genre stuff because it had effects in it, and that part of it makes a lot of sense. But I started thinking this morning about What's Up, Doc, and just how much that movie just takes you on this ridiculous, ludicrous sort of screwball comedy. But it's one of my favorite movies, so I couldn't, you know, when I thought about it today, I went, no, I didn't put that on my list, but God, I love that movie so much. It's just so fun. And everybody that you talk about that movie to that has seen it, that's like that immediately people respond to it.
Yeah, I went back to it recently. I guess there was a new Blu-ray or something maybe in the last year, and my wife Nancy had not seen it. And there's always that thing with, I think, with comedy more than almost anything, because so much of it doesn't age well. And there was just this like little tingling fear in the back of my head, like, oh God, what if What's Up, Doc doesn't work anymore? And you're 10 minutes into it and it's working like a maniac. It's such a great film. It's so funny.
It's funny. Even when I first visited Los Angeles, I came out to LA in 1976. It was the first time I ever visited LA, summer of 76. I think Logan's Run had come out. It was before Star Wars, because I remember Logan's Run was like a big deal then. And we were driving down the 405 freeway, and Kenneth Mars was in the car next to us.
Oh!
It was my parents and my uncle and my cousins. And we looked over, and Kenneth Mars was there. And, you know, that was after, you know, Young Frankenstein and What's Up, Doc. And we started waving. Like, we were like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And he kind of waved, and at one point, I think he just sort of slowed down and let us pass him. And then I did, when I moved to LA and I started my company, one of the first movies we did was one of the Police Academy movies, and we had to make a mask of Kenneth Mars. And Kenneth Mars came to K&D.
Oh, wow.
And we did a face cast of him, and I told him that story. I said, you know, when I was a kid, we came to California, and you were in the car next to us, and you were waving, and we were sort of like driving along. And I told him how much I loved What's Up, Doc. And I'll never forget, he said, that movie was so much fucking fun to make, I cannot tell you. And it sort of warmed my heart.
Oh, that's so good to hear.
I was really excited to have said, oh man, you know, I'm friends with Josh Brolin, and I keep like wanting to tell Josh to get Barbara Streisand to sign a picture for me from What's Up, Doc, because it's such a great movie.
Yes. And that is our generation's Barbara Streisand, isn't it? I mean, she's...
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
She's so cute in that movie. I have such a thing for What's Up, Doc, yes. Barbara Streisand. Yes. Yes. Anyway.
I'm looking for my list to make sure I didn't leave anything out. Stuff that I was talking. Oh, I did hit a lot of it. Wow, that's kind of.
Oh, funny. Wow. Yeah, no, but I know you got more.
I do. Well, you know, like, listen, staying in the.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Staying in the comedy, sort of the comedy vein, you know, Little Shop of Horrors, the Rick Moranis version was a movie that I was so sort of enthralled with. You know, one of the criteria I always talk about, like, if a movie transports me, I consider that a successful movie. You know, I mean, if it transports me to another world,
sure,
another place, like I feel, you know, I feel like I've gotten what I want out of that movie. And there were a certain number of movies that I felt very, very successfully transported me or suspended my disbelief enough that I kind of went, oh, yeah, of course. Like, I remember Dragon Slayer did the same kind of thing for me. I remember feeling transported by that movie. Like, I kind of at one point thought they must have gone to Europe and went into a cave and found a real dragon and filmed with it, because I believed it. And that was after I was sort of in the business and kind of starting to learn how things were done, how things, you know, how effects were created. So when I watched Little Shop of Horrors and I saw Rick Moranis singing with the giant plant, I sat in the theater next to my friends and I'm like, I don't know how they did that. I don't know how they so seamlessly, like, now if they made that movie, it would all be digital, it would all be CGI. But when you realize, much like Aliens, you know, they used every single trick in the book. You know, there was a miniature, and then they would record things at a slower speed and speed up the film so that the lip sync could match the puppet, so that Rick Moranis had to act slower so that the puppet could keep up with him.
Oh, God. And he was singing to a slowed down track of himself so that he could...
To a slowed down track. But the funny thing about it was, I didn't care, because I didn't think about any of those things when I was watching the movie. All I was thinking about was, well, somehow they found a singing plant and they shot this movie before it ate all of them.
Wait a minute. You were in the business when that movie came out, weren't you?
I was, but it didn't matter. It was so successful. It was so successful to me that I really believed it. I believed.
That's so great.
And I really feel like movies that take me to that place.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, The Howling is another movie, again, that I believe. You know, I watch those things and I see those moments and I'm shocked. And I'm when I can't figure out how it was done, and especially a guy who studied it and still studies it, it's really fun for me to be fooled, because I want to be fooled, because my job is to fool other people. My job is to convince other people that what I'm putting in front of them is real. So to appreciate the craft of these filmmakers that fooled me, I got to give it to them, you know. And
yeah, that's such an important thing. And I find so many people, you know, there's a version of that in my line of work with writers where, you know, people pride themselves on seeing plot twists coming and all the rest of that. And I find, to me, there's just nothing more joyful than being completely, as you say, fooled by a movie and not seeing it coming. And some of it is like, I don't want to be. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be fooled. I do want to be fooled. I don't want to, you know, be sitting there thinking about how they did it while I'm watching it. So it's great that.
I thought on Little Shop they made a mistake jettisoning the original ending.
Oh, right.
Which you can now see on YouTube.
Yes.
Instead of this fabulous spectacle at the end of the picture, where the plants get loose and knock down the city and all that stuff. They decided to stay inside a little room.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was because, well, it's more true to the original movie, which was shot in 2.5 days. And so we don't want ours to be too big. But I just thought, especially having seen how great it is, I don't understand the thinking behind it.
Yeah, it's I always was confused by that too, especially, and I didn't even know about it until I read the Cinefex article. And there was a photo of Ellen Green, Rick Moranis wrapped up in the tentacle being lowered to the Audrey 2's mouth. And I remember looking at that going, wait, what is that? And when I read the article, and then they showed pictures of all the miniatures of them taking over, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge and all the buildings and taking over the world. And again, the spirit of Little Shop of Horrors in that movie is that, you know, the plants are taking over the world. So I think it was just some bad decision of like, well, we can't have an ending where everybody dies. We got to have a little, you know, we got to save the girl and we got to have a happy ending. But, you know, I ran out and bought that Laserdisc or DVD that had the footage on there immediately when that came out, because a lot of it was like the work print black and white footage. Mm-hmm. And I know it's on there now, but I don't know if they ever cut the whole alternate.
I don't know if they ever finished it. I think it may still be a work in progress, but it's still pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's a kind of rough thing on the Blu-ray where you can look at the alternate ending, but I don't think it's fully produced.
Yeah, but it's funny because you think about movies like that now, a then and now scenario, and part of the reason, and I'm gonna jump into Aliens for just a minute, because yeah. I watched it the other day with my 14-year-old daughter, and what I admire about that movie is Jim Cameron used every trick in the book. He used rear projection. Yep. He used quarter scale miniatures. He used guys in suits. He used front projection. He used every single trick in the book to tell that story. And I so admired that. And it's interesting because I read an article in DGA magazine about a year ago where he said, oh, if I made that movie today, everything would be digital. And it really, that comment really made me sad, because I feel like part of the triumph is figuring out how the fuck to do it. Like using those, and Joe, I'd be curious to hear what you think about that in terms of that sort of technology, because, you know, sometimes people are a slave to what technology is available to them at the time. But what works with a movie like Aliens or Little Shop of Horrors, or The Howling, and a lot of these was what technology was available to us at the time. And the fact that Jim said, oh, I would go back and I would redo some of that stuff in the movie, would be a very different movie. I feel like some of what makes Aliens a great movie is that he embraced the technology that was available to him at the time, you know?
I agree with that. And I think that some of the movies that we made were improved by the fact that we couldn't just snap our fingers and have something appear. You know, we had to figure out interesting ways to do it and practical ways to do it. And we've failed a lot of times. I mean, there's a lot of footage in these movies that you didn't get to see because it didn't work. You know, we had to think of something else. And sometimes the journey to get to that other place actually makes it better.
Yeah.
And I always use the example of, you know, how excited everybody always was at the beginning of the James Bond movies when there would be some terrific stunt. Somebody would ski off a mountain, or they would sort of flying car or whatever the fuck they would do. And once CGI came along, everybody went, oh, well, it's fake.
Yeah.
And now they didn't really do it. That guy didn't really risk his life. Like, you know, it's all done with mirrors. And it just takes away, I think, a lot of the immediacy of what you think you're experiencing.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And even when people want to go back and futz with stuff that was done back then, to me, when you get a job on a film, the first few meetings to me are always the most exciting because everything's on the table. You know, I mean, we know budgets and we know like there are always limitations, but it's almost like when you have VFX, there are no limitations. And because there aren't limitations, everything and anything can happen. So you have a frame of a downtown street with some big fight going on. Everything that can move and everything that can explode and everything that could shatter does in the course of a frame. So you become overloaded with it, and it's less impactful.
Well, if you've seen 1917, you know that very spectacular scene with the bombs going off and running around, and yeah. It's almost all fake. I mean, there's almost nothing real in that material, and people who went to the Bake Off at the Academy and looked at the special effects, you know, they ran their reel and they showed what they had done, and people were astonished. It was almost like in Gravity that it's practically a cartoon, except for the faces of the actors, because it's all done in the computer, and not to take away from these movies because they're very well done, but there's so much more going on than meets the eye. To the average viewer, that they don't realize how special effects have actually conquered Hollywood to the point where you can't just go out and shoot anything anymore without having to do something to it in post.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting about that is when you're forced with a situation on set where you have to figure out a way to make it work. I mean, I think so much. So much on the editors and on the directors, because you're taking the frames of footage that do work and having to craft something out of it. You know, I mean, it's like watching the dailies of the chestburster scene from Alien, where the chestburster looks absolutely ludicrous. It just sticks out and you hear the pistons moving and then the blood is spraying, but it doesn't look real. And you realize after looking at all that footage that Ridley and I think Terry Rollins edited that movie, the idea that they could take minute pieces of film together and craft one of the most terrifying sequences in our generation, but they don't have to do that now. They wouldn't have to do that now. They'd be like, oh, well, we'll just string it all along in one particular fashion or another. So a lot of the artistry that is required by filmmakers and technicians to be able to sit down and figure out how they're going to do it, how are we going to do this, as opposed is to me part of the most fun of any process of making a film, is determining that. And so often it's like, oh, well, we'll just do it digitally. That kind of takes, for me, it takes a lot of the fun out of it, because then we're not being challenged with how are you going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that just blew me away about Alien at the time was you know, the slow realization as I became sort of obsessed with it, and you'd read articles and look at all those photos and video of behind the scenes stuff, is that, you know, there were some technical advancements that were new to the medium, but very few. It was really just really clever direction, how to deal with shooting this stuff in a way that was more dynamic than you'd seen before. I mean, it's just incredible to me to this day. Joe and I have this argument sometimes. He has some issues with it, but the fact that it's just a guy in a rubber suit, it's still this terrifying thing I felt like I'd never seen before.
Well, you know, I mean, that's kind of the way that it breaks down. And, you know, like werewolf transformations were changed forever because of the Howling. And you know,
yeah,
understanding the pieces of film that you use and how you want to change somebody into a creature, and you know, that set the standard for so long, mm-hmm. for years, until computer and digital effects came on. But now you know that you're not watching something change in front of you; you're watching a computer programmer enter a bunch of data, and it's just it's not the same, and it will never be the same. And you know, I think with the advent of video games, people are okay with it. People play video games. So when they watch a movie and the movie looks like their video game, they're okay with it because they're comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But it is, yeah, the Howling's a good example too of I hadn't seen Joe will tell me there were five more before it, but you know, up until then, it seems to be that werewolf transformations were, you know, your lead actor staring at the camera while they did time-lapse photography and added the makeup to his face. And just the simple idea of...
That was pretty much the standard, yeah.
Right, but just the simple idea of moving the camera and cutting and doing different angles of that.
Well, but going into it, the way we sold them and doing the picture was we said we want to do the transformation in one shot. Now, it didn't occur to me until I actually started working on it that not only was that really difficult to do, but it was also anti-dramatic. Because when Manimal came out on TV, you know, they had this guy was turning into animals in one shot, and it was all done, you know, and the Michael Jackson video has the same thing. And it's like, okay,
right,
been there, done that. I've seen it now, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you take away the idea of editing and the idea of characters reacting to what's going on as audience surrogates, then you can get away with a lot more than if you just sort of plunk it down and say, okay, here's the effect. Now it's over. Cut to the next scene.
But it's you know, we're on the other side of it now. It seems like such an obvious solution. Just shoot it the way you would shoot any other scene, basically.
Yeah.
And it took decades for someone to figure that out.
You know, when you're Jack Pierce trying to make Lon Chaney into the Wolfman, I mean, they even in that series, they progressed from the first picture where they had only one transformation, and it was back, not forward. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they made the sequel, they had gotten a little bit better at doing the transformations.
Right.
And so the transformations are a little better. And then interestingly, by the time they got to the Abbott Costello movie, the Jack Pierce approach had been completely abandoned, as had Jack Pierce. And now the Westmores were in there, and it was all just facial masks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The shape of the nose was different, and its sculpture was completely different.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine, but it's not as good as the original.
No, I agree. But it's interesting that you would say that in terms of how not dramatic a werewolf transformation would be in one shot, because there's something interesting conceptually about like, oh, I'd love to see what that looks like. But it doesn't. But, you know, I mean, what always was so fantastic about your transformation was, you know, the Dee Wallace was in the room and you could cut to her reacting.
Yeah.
And that made it more terrifying for the audience,
right?
Because we had another character to react to. I have to tell you a funny story, Joe. So, you know, I started acquiring a few props here and there from someone who was friends with Rob Bottin, and I recently acquired the full standing rod puppet from The Howling.
Wow.
The one that the Shank brothers built in their driveway.
Right. And the one that we couldn't use very much of in the movie because you'd have to have it up against a wall and it couldn't move. I mean, it was great looking.
Yeah.
But when it came time to actually shoot it, it was like, well, it's not the most practical prop.
Yes. Well, it ended up being in somebody's garage and they would put it out
for Halloween.
Every year for Halloween in their yard with a cape on it. But it's
like the wolf and Little Red Riding Hood all in the same.
It's what it looked like. I'll send you a picture, but we're going to restore it. We're going to fix the head. Looks fantastic. It's just missing, you know, the foam rotted in the corners, but we're going to restore the whole thing to what it looked like.
Wow.
I'll have you guys over when it's ready.
That'll be great. The foam is always tough. It's the first thing to go. All my gremlins have they're foaming. They're foaming at the mouth, literally.
Oh, sure.
Well, there's a friend of mine on the East Coast named Tom Spina who's kind of developed a technique to preserve all that foam.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Anyway, but I was excited because I remember seeing that picture in Cine Fantastique and just seeing that the full werewolf, because you know. When we were younger, you know, when you saw monsters, a lot of times, you know, the intent was to keep them in shadow and to keep them mysterious. And, you know, Alien was a perfect example. You had no idea what it really looked like until you saw that shot of it being jettisoned from the back of the ship. But, you know, with The Howling, especially when, you know, when the werewolf grabs the file from Belinda's hand and you have that that unforgettable shot from behind her of the thing rearing up. Oh man, that's one of my favorite shots in horror history, because it stopped me in my tracks for that exact second of like, oh my God, it's like seeing the shark, you know, eating Teddy Grossman for the first time. You're like, oh my God, that thing's huge. Like, how are they ever going to beat that?
The fun thing about that was when the picture opened in New York at the Lowe's Theater, there were two theaters. One was above the other, and the show times were staggered by about 5 minutes. And so you could watch a reaction to that scene, and then you could run upstairs to the next theater and go in the projection booth and watch it again, and it would be exactly the same. And it was just like you described. It was like a field of wheat. When people have these reactions, it's just a billow that from the front of the audience to the back of the audience. And for some reason, the ones in the front always react quicker than the ones in the back
because they're closer to it.
they're a little closer. I don't know why. There's suddenly a short story popped out of my mind. Someone used to write this of the director in that situation. But when you run to the other theater, there's no reaction at all.
But worse, there's nobody there.
Oh, that, yeah, that's a nightmare.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that, it's funny too. That shot always, I mean, it comes late enough in the film, just the hand coming into the frame. And you've seen so much amazing stuff that you've not seen before that's incredible and effective. And then, I mean, in some ways, just that simple thing with a hand coming in might be the scariest thing in the entire movie. I'm ruining it for all of our listeners to the Joe Dante.
Oh, I've seen it. It's such a chestnut. I've
never seen it.
Actually, Joe, when we did Nightmare Cinema, I had Belinda sign that still for me. So I have that photo. But again, I mean, I think just the way that, and that goes back to sort of the fascination with part of our psyche that wants to see the whole monster. Because when you see the whole monster, you can in your head process what it is you're looking at and like, oh, well, it's not so bad, or it's way worse than I thought it was. But in The Howling, because of the way you see it and then it swats at her and knocks her over, I mean, it's got power and it's that great backlight that you had on it. It just leaves you with just an amazing sense of, I don't know what the hell this thing is capable of doing. So then in the next bit, when the transformation happens, you know, it just changed everything for me, for sure, in terms of what I wanted to do. So.
Well, that, oh, wow. Really? Yeah.
That makes me proud to think that it led to all this great work.
It's amazing.
And now here we
are. And now your crowning achievement, appearing on movies.
Yeah.
Appearing on Joe's podcast.
Yes. Well, listen, guys, I mean, it's there's so much amazing stuff. And then, you know, then you kind of veer into the campy world of the stuff that I loved when I was a kid, you know, like War of the Gargantuas and the Green Slime and, you know, like all the Godzilla movies, which in no means anybody should ever love, because they're just so obscenely ridiculous, but you can't help it. I mean,
and now they're all together on one gigantic Criterion DVD.
They are indeed. I haven't picked that up yet, but I think that was part of where that sort of started my fascination with miniatures, was knowing that there was these guys that would build sound stages filled with models of a city street. And then you put a guy in a rubber suit and then he just runs through and steps on all of them. Like, to me, that's probably like, if I ever had a last wish, if it's like, okay, you get one last wish, I would probably say, I want to be in a Godzilla suit and I want to run through a sound stage of miniature buildings with pyrotechnics in them. I can't think of anything more satisfying than, you know, when my younger brother Brian and I would, and they would plow the driveways in Pittsburgh near in our house, they would leave all the snow piled up at the end, and we would pretend that that was a city, and we would stand on top of it and we would stomp on the snow as if we were crushing miniature buildings.
Yes.
I haven't thought of that in 40 years.
Paint up anger here.
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Greg, thank you so much for coming out and doing this, Joe. I don't know if you know this. Greg is taking off now to race across town and be on Mick Garris's podcast.
Oh, for God's sake, don't say anything you said on our podcast.
I will.
I was thinking we should try to keep him long, and I was going to email Mick and blackmail him into, you know, giving him his guest.
Now, does Mick actually does his podcast from where?
No, he's not. He's doing it from his
You know, but I will say you guys have been pursuing me longer than Mick has. Because gosh, you and I talked a couple, and I know,
yes,
Joe, I know we've talked about, you know, the Trailers from Hell for right. a long time. I'm never around. I mean, you know,
I
am now. Exactly.
Well, I just want to register then that our love for you is sincere.
And more long lasting.
Mick is just a Johnny come lately.
Yeah. Well, I'm honored and I'm grateful that you guys wanted me on. And listen, I mean, it's been a blast. And Joe, I'm always excited to get a chance to talk to you. And Josh, thank you.
Listen, it took a pandemic for you to be available.
Yeah.
I'll try harder next time.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.